30. Dunbar. Yossarian no longer gave a damn where his bombs fell, although he did not go as far as Dunbar, who dropped his bombs hundreds of yards past the village and would face a court-martial if it could ever be shown he had done it deliberately. Without a word even to Yossarian, Dunbar had washed his hands of the mission. The fall in the hospital had either shown him the light or scrambled his brains. It was impossible to say which. Dunbar seldom laughed anymore, and seemed to be wasting away. He snarled belligerently at superior officers, even at Major Danby, and was crude and surly and profane even in front of the chaplain, who was afraid of Dunbar now and seemed to be wasting away also. The chaplain's pilgrimage to Wintergreen had proved abortive. Another shrine was empty. Wintergreen was too busy to see the chaplain himself. A brash assistant brought the chaplain a stolen Zippo cigarette lighter as a gift and informed him condescendingly that Wintergreen was too deeply involved with wartime activities to concern himself with matters so trivial as the number of missions men had to fly. The chaplain worried about Dunbar and brooded more over Yossarian now that Orr was gone. To the chaplain, who lived by himself in a spacious tent whose pointy top sealed him in gloomy solitude each night like the cap of a tomb, it seemed incredible that Yossarian really preferred living alone and wanted no roommates. As a lead bombardier again, Yossarian had McWatt for a pilot, and that was one consolation, although he was still so utterly undefended. There was no way to fight back. He could not even see McWatt and the co-pilot from his post in the nose. All he could ever see was Arfi, with whose fustian moon-faced ineptitude he had finally lost all patience, and there were minutes of agonizing fury and frustration in the sky when he hungered to be demoted again to a wing plane with a loaded machine gun in the compartment instead of the precision bomb sight that he really had no need for. A powerful, heavy 50-caliber machine gun he could seize vengefully in both hands and turn loose savagely against all the demons tyrannizing him, at the smoky black puffs of the flak itself, at the German anti-aircraft gunners below, whom he could not even see and could not possibly harm with his machine gun, even if he ever did take the time to open fire, at Havermeyer and Appleby in the lead plane for their fearless straight and level bomb run on the third mission to Bologna, where the flak from 224 cannons had knocked out one of Orr's engines for the very last time and sent him down, ditching into the sea between Genoa and La Spezia, just before the brief thunderstorm broke. Actually, there was not much he could do with that powerful machine gun, except load it and test fire a few rounds. It was no more use to him than the bomb sight. He could really cut loose with it against attacking German fighters, but there were no German fighters anymore, and he could not even swing it all the way around into the helpless faces of pilots like Hoople and Dobbs and order them back down carefully to the ground, as he had once ordered Kid Sampson back down, which is exactly what he did want to do to Dobbs and Hoople on the hideous first mission to Avignon, the moment he realized the fantastic pickle he was in, the moment he found himself aloft in a wing plane with Dobbs and Hoople in the flight headed by Havermeyer and Appleby. Dobbs and Hoople? Hoople and Dobbs? Who were they? What preposterous madness to float in thin air 2 miles high on an inch or two of metal, sustained from death by the meager skill and intelligence of 2 vapid strangers, a beardless kid named Hoople and a nervous nut like Dobbs, who really did go nuts right there in the plane, running amok over the target without leaving his co-pilot seat and grabbing the controls from Hoople to plunge them all down into that chilling dive that tore Yossarian's headset loose and brought them right back inside the dense flak from which they had almost escaped. The next thing he knew, another stranger, a radio gunner named Snowden, was dying in back. It was impossible to be positive that Dobbs had killed him, for when Yossarian plugged his headset back in, Dobbs was already on the intercom pleading for someone to go up front and help the bombardier. And almost immediately Snowden broke in, whimpering, "Help me. Please help me. I'm cold. I'm cold. And Yossarian crawled slowly out of the nose and up on top of the bomb bay and wriggled back into the rear section of the plane, passing the first aid kit on the way that he had to return for to treat Snowden for the wrong wound. The yawning, raw, melon-shaped hole as big as a football in the outside of his thigh, the unsevered, blood-soaked muscle fibers inside pulsating weirdly like blind things with lives of their own. The oval, naked wound that was almost a foot long and made Yossarian moan in shock and sympathy the instant he spied it and nearly made him vomit. And the small, slight tail gunner was lying on the floor beside Snowden in a dead faint, his face as white as a handkerchief, so that Yossarian sprang forward with revulsion to help him first. Yes, in the long run he was much safer flying with McWatt. And he was not even safe with McWatt, who loved flying too much and went buzzing boldly inches off the ground with Yossarian in the nose on the way back from the training flight to break in the new bombardier and the whole replacement crew Colonel Cathcart had obtained after Orr was lost. The practice bomb range was on the other side of Pianosa, and flying back, McWatt edged the belly of the lazing, slow-cruising plane just over the crest of mountains in the middle, and then, instead of maintaining altitude, jolted both engines open all the way, lurched up on one side, and to Yossarian's astonishment, began following the falling land down as fast as the plane would go, wagging his wings gaily and skimming with a massive, grinding, hammering roar over each rocky rise and dip of the rolling terrain like a dizzy gull over wild brown waves. Yossarian was petrified. The new bombardier beside him sat demurely with a bewitched grin and kept whistling, "Whee!" And Yossarian wanted to reach out and crush his idiotic face with one hand as he flinched and flung himself away from the boulders and hillocks and lashing branches of trees that loomed up above him out in front and rushed past just underneath in a sinking, streaking blur. No one had a right to take such frightful risks with his life. "Go up! Go up! Go up!" he shouted frantically at McWatt, hating him venomously. But McWatt was singing buoyantly over the intercom and probably couldn't hear. Yossarian, blazing with rage and almost sobbing for revenge, hurled himself down into the crawlway and fought his way through against the dragging weight of gravity and inertia until he arrived at the main section and pulled himself up to the flight deck to stand trembling behind McWatt in the pilot seat. He looked desperately about for a gun, a gray-black .45 automatic that he could cock and ram right up against the base of McWatt's skull. There was no gun. There was no hunting knife either, and no other weapon with which he could bludgeon or stab, and Yossarian grasped and jerked the collar of McWatt's coveralls in tightening fists and shouted to him to go up, go up. The land was still swimming by underneath and flashing by overhead on both sides. McWatt looked back at Yossarian and laughed joyfully, as though Yossarian were sharing his fun. Yossarian slid both hands around McWatt's bare throat and squeezed. McWatt turned stiff. "Go up!" Yossarian ordered unmistakably through his teeth in a low, menacing voice, "or I'll kill you!" Rigid with caution, McWatt cut the motors back and climbed gradually. Yossarian's hands weakened on McWatt's neck and slid down off his shoulders to dangle inertly. He was not angry anymore. He was ashamed. When McWatt turned, he was sorry the hands were his and wished there was some place where he could bury them. They felt dead. McWatt gazed at him deeply. There was no friendliness in his stare. "Boy," he said coldly, "you sure must be in pretty bad shape. You ought to go home." "They won't let me," Yossarian answered with averted eyes, and crept away. Yossarian stepped down from the flight deck and seated himself on the floor, hanging his head with guilt and remorse. He was covered with sweat. McWatt set course directly back toward the field. Yossarian wondered whether McWatt would now go to the operations tent to see Pilchard and Wren and request that Yossarian never be assigned to his plane again, just as Yossarian had gone surreptitiously to speak to them about Dobbs and Hoople and Orr, and unsuccessfully about Arfi. He had never seen McWatt look displeased before, had never seen him in any but the most lighthearted mood, and he wondered whether he had just lost another friend. But McWatt winked at him reassuringly as he climbed down from the plane and joshed hospitably with the credulous new pilot and bombardier during the jeep ride back to the squadron, although he did not address a word to Yossarian until all four had returned their parachutes and separated, and the two of them were walking side by side toward their own row of tents. Then McWatt's sparsely freckled, tan Scotch-Irish face broke suddenly into a smile, and he dug his knuckles playfully into Yossarian's ribs as though throwing a punch. "You louse," he laughed. "Were you really going to kill me up there?" Yossarian grinned penitently and shook his head. "No, I don't think so. I didn't realize you got it so bad. Boy, why don't you talk to somebody about it?" "I talked to everybody about it. What the hell's the matter with you? Don't you ever hear me?" "I guess I never really believed you." "Aren't you ever afraid?" "Maybe I ought to be. Not even on the missions?" "I guess I just don't have brains enough," McWatt laughed sheepishly. "There are so many ways for me to get killed," Yossarian commented, "and you had to find one more." McWatt smiled again. "Say, I bet it really must scare you when I buzz your tent, huh?" "It scares me to death. I've told you that." "I thought it was just the noise you were complaining about." McWatt made a resigned shrug. "Oh, well, what the hell," he sang. "I guess I'll just have to give it up." But McWatt was incorrigible, and while he never buzzed Yossarian's tent again, he never missed an opportunity to buzz the beach and roar like a fierce and low-flying thunderbolt over the raft in the water and the secluded hollow in the sand where Yossarian lay feeling up Nurse Duckett or playing hearts, poker, or pinochle with Nately Dunbar and Hungry Joe. Yossarian met Nurse Duckett almost every afternoon that both were free and came with her to the beach on the other side of the narrow swell of shoulder-high dunes separating them from the area in which the other officers and enlisted men went swimming nude. Nately Dunbar and Hungry Joe would come there, too. McWatt would occasionally join them, and often Arfi, who always arrived pudgily in full uniform and never removed any of his clothing but his shoes and his hat. Arfi never went swimming. The other men wore swimming trunks in deference to Nurse Duckett, and in deference also to Nurse Kramer, who accompanied Nurse Duckett and Yossarian to the beach every time and sat haughtily by herself 10 yards away. No one but Arfi ever made reference to the naked men sunbathing in full view farther down the beach, or jumping and diving from the enormous whitewashed raft that bobbed on empty oil drums out beyond the silt sandbar. Nurse Kramer sat by herself because she was angry with Yossarian and disappointed in Nurse Duckett. Nurse Sue Ann Duckett despised Arfi, and that was another one of the numerous fetching traits about Nurse Duckett that Yossarian enjoyed. He enjoyed Nurse Sue Ann Duckett's long white legs and supple calipagus ass. He often neglected to remember that she was quite slim and fragile from the waist up and hurt her unintentionally in moments of passion when he hugged her too roughly. He loved her manner of sleepy acquiescence when they lay on the beach at dusk. He drew solace and sedation from her nearness. He had a craving to touch her always, to remain always in physical communication. He liked to encircle her ankle loosely with his fingers as he played cards with Nately, Dunbar, and Hungry Joe, to lightly and lovingly caress the downy skin of her fair smooth thigh with the backs of his nails, or dreamily, sensuously, almost unconsciously slide his proprietary respectful hand up the shell-like ridge of her spine beneath the elastic strap of the top of the two-piece bathing suit she always wore to contain and cover her tiny, long-nippled breasts. He loved Nurse Duckett's serene, flattered response, the sense of attachment to him she displayed proudly. Hungry Joe had a craving to feel Nurse Duckett up, too, and was restrained more than once by Yossarian's forbidding glower. Nurse Duckett flirted with Hungry Joe, just to keep him in heat, and her round, light brown eyes glimmered with mischief every time Yossarian rapped her sharply with his elbow or fist to make her stop. The men played cards on a towel, undershirt, or blanket, and Nurse Duckett mixed the extra deck of cards, sitting with her back resting against a sand dune. When she was not shuffling the extra deck of cards, she sat squinting into a tiny pocket mirror, brushing mascara on her curling reddish eyelashes in a bird-brained effort to make them longer permanently. Occasionally, she was able to stack the cards or spoil the deck in a way they did not discover until they were well into the game, and she laughed and glowed with blissful gratification when they all hurled their cards down disgustedly and began punching her sharply on the arms or legs as they called her filthy names and warned her to stop fooling around. She would prattle nonsensically when they were striving hardest to think, and a pink flush of elation crept into her cheeks when they gave her more sharp raps on the arms and legs with their fists and told her to shut up. Nurse Duckett reveled in such attention and ducked her short chestnut bangs with joy when Yossarian and the others focused upon her. It gave her a peculiar feeling of warm and expectant well-being to know that so many naked boys and men were idling close by on the other side of the sand dunes. She had only to stretch her neck or rise on some pretext to see 20 or 40 undressed males lounging or playing ball in the sunlight. Her own body was such a familiar and unremarkable thing to her that she was puzzled by the convulsive ecstasy men could take from it, by the intense and amusing need they had merely to touch it, to reach out urgently and press it, squeeze it, pinch it, rub it. She did not understand Yossarian's lust, but she was willing to take his word for it. Evenings when Yossarian felt horny, he brought Nurse Duckett to the beach with 2 blankets and enjoyed making love to her with most of their clothes on, more than he sometimes enjoyed making love to all the vigorous, bare, amoral girls in Rome. Frequently, they went to the beach at night and did not make love, but just lay shivering between the blankets against each other to ward off the brisk, damp chill. The ink-black nights were turning cold, the stars frosty and fewer. The raft swayed in the ghostly trail of moonlight and seemed to be sailing away. A marked hint of cold weather penetrated the air. Other men were just starting to build stoves and came to Yossarian's tent during the day to marvel at Orr's workmanship. It thrilled Nurse Duckett rapturously that Yossarian could not keep his hands off her when they were together, although she would not let him slip them inside her bathing shorts during the day when anyone was near enough to see, not even when the only witness was Nurse Kramer, who sat on the other side of her sand dune with her reproving nose in the air and pretended not to see anything. Nurse Kramer had stopped speaking to Nurse Duckett, her best friend, because of her liaison with Yossarian, but still went everywhere with Nurse Duckett, since Nurse Duckett was her best friend. She did not approve of Yossarian or his friends. When they stood up and went swimming with Nurse Duckett, Nurse Kramer stood up and went swimming too, maintaining the same 10-yard distance between them, and maintaining her silence, snubbing them even in the water. When they laughed and splashed, she laughed and splashed. When they dived, she dived. When they swam to the sandbar and rested, Nurse Kramer swam to the sandbar and rested. When they came out, she came out, dried her shoulders with her own towel, and seated herself aloofly in her own spot, her back rigid, and a ring of reflected sunlight burnishing her light blonde hair like a halo. Nurse Kramer was prepared to begin talking to Nurse Duckett again, if she repented and apologized. Nurse Duckett preferred things the way they were. For a long time, she had wanted to give Nurse Kramer a rap to make her shut up. Nurse Duckett found Yossarian wonderful and was already trying to change him. She loved to watch him taking short naps with his face down and his arms thrown across her, or staring bleakly at the endless, tame, quiet waves, breaking like pet puppy dogs against the shore, scampering lightly up the sand a foot or two, and then trotting away. She was calm in his silences. She knew she did not bore him, and she buffed or painted her fingernails studiously while he dozed or brooded, and the desultory warm afternoon breeze vibrated delicately on the surface of the beach. She loved to look at his wide, long, sinewy back with its bronzed, unblemished skin. She loved to bring him to flame instantly by taking his whole ear in her mouth suddenly and running her hand down his front all the way. She loved to make him burn and suffer till dark, then satisfy him, then kiss him adoringly because she had brought him such bliss. Yossarian was never lonely with Nurse Duckett, who really did know how to keep her mouth shut and was just capricious enough. He was haunted and tormented by the vast, boundless ocean. He wondered mournfully as Nurse Duckett buffed her nails about all the people who had died underwater. There were surely more than 1 million already. Where were they? What insects had eaten their flesh? He imagined the awful impotence of breathing in helplessly quarts and quarts of water. Yossarian followed the small fishing boats and military launches, plying back and forth far out, and found them unreal. It did not seem true that there were full-sized men aboard, going somewhere every time. He looked toward stony Elba, and his eyes automatically searched overhead for the fluffy white turnip-shaped cloud in which Clevenger had vanished. He peered at the vaporous Italian skyline and thought of Orr. Clevenger and Orr. Where had they gone? Yossarian had once stood on a jetty at dawn and watched a tufted round log that was drifting toward him on the tide turn unexpectedly into the bloated face of a drowned man. It was the first dead person he'd ever seen. He thirsted for life and reached out ravenously to grasp and hold Nurse Duckett's flesh. He studied every floating object fearfully, for some gruesome sign of Clevenger and Orr, prepared for any morbid shock. But the shock McWatt gave him one day, with the plane that came blasting suddenly into sight out of the distant stillness, and hurtled mercilessly along the shoreline with a great, growling, clattering roar of the bobbing raft on which blonde, pale Kid Samson, his naked side scrawny even from so far away, leaped clownishly up to touch it at the exact moment some arbitrary gust of wind or minor miscalculation of McWatt's senses dropped the speeding plane down just low enough for a propeller to slice him half away. Even people who were not there remembered vividly exactly what happened next. There was the briefest, softest filtering audibly through the shattering, overwhelming howl of the plane's engines, and then there were just Kid Samson's two pale, skinny legs, still joined by strings somehow at the bloody truncated hips, standing stock still on the raft for what seemed a full minute or two, before they toppled over backward into the water finally, with a faint echoing splash, and turned completely upside down, so that only the grotesque toes and the plaster-white soles of Kid Samson's feet remained in view. On the beach, all hell broke loose. Nurse Kramer materialized out of thin air suddenly and was weeping hysterically against Yossarian's chest while Yossarian hugged her shoulders and soothed her. His other arm bolstered Nurse Duckett, who was trembling and sobbing against him too, her long, angular face dead white. Everyone at the beach was screaming and running, and the men sounded like women. They scampered for their things in panic, stooping hurriedly and looking askance at each gentle knee-high wave bubbling in, as though some ugly red grisly organ like a liver or a lung might come washing right up against them. Those in the water were struggling to get out, forgetting in their haste to swim. wailing, walking, held back in their flight by the viscous, clinging sea as though by a biting wind. Kid Samson had rained all over. Those who spied drops of him on their limbs or torsos drew back with terror and revulsion, as though trying to shrink away from their own odious skins. Everybody ran in a sluggish stampede, shooting tortured, horrified glances back, filling the deep, shadowy, rustling woods with their frail gasps and cries. Yossarian drove both stumbling, faltering women before him frantically, shoving them and prodding them to make them hurry, and raced back with a curse to help when Hungry Joe tripped on the blanket or the camera case he was carrying and fell forward on his face in the mud of the stream. Back at the squadron, everyone already knew. Men in uniform were screaming and running there, too, or standing motionless in one spot, rooted in awe, like Sergeant Knight and Dr. Nika, as they gravely craned their heads upward and watched the guilty, banking, forlorn airplane with McWatt circle and circle slowly and climb.
"Who is it?"
Yossarian shouted anxiously at Dr. Nika as he ran up, breathless and limp, his somber eyes burning with a misty, hectic anguish.
"Who's in the plane?"
"McWatt," said Sergeant Knight. "He's got the two new pilots with him on a training flight. Dr. Nika's up there, too."
"I'm right here,"
contended Dr. Nika in a strange and troubled voice, darting an anxious look at Sergeant Knight.
"Why doesn't he come down?"
Yossarian exclaimed in despair.
"Why does he keep going up?"
"He's probably afraid to come down,"
Sergeant Knight answered without moving his solemn gaze from McWatt's solitary climbing airplane.
"He knows what kind of trouble he's in."
And McWatt kept climbing higher and higher, nosing his droning airplane upward evenly in a slow oval spiral that carried him far out over the water, as he headed south and far in over the russet foothills when he had circled the landing field again and was flying north. He was soon up over 5,000 feet. His engines were soft as whispers. A white parachute popped open suddenly in a surprising puff. A second parachute popped open a few moments later and coasted down, like the first, directly in toward the clearing of the landing strip. There was no motion on the ground. The plane continued south for 30 seconds more, following the same pattern, familiar and predictable now, and McWatt lifted a wing and banked gracefully around into his turn.
"Two more to go," said Sergeant Knight. "McWatt and Dr. Nika."
"I'm right here, Sergeant Knight," Dr. Nika told him plaintively. "I'm not in the plane."
"Why don't they jump?"
Sergeant Knight asked, pleading aloud to himself.
"Why don't they jump?"
"It doesn't make sense," grieved Dr. Nika, biting his lip. "It just doesn't make sense."
But Yossarian understood suddenly why McWatt wouldn't jump, and went running uncontrollably down the whole length of the squadron after McWatt's plane, waving his arms and shouting up at him imploringly to come down, McWatt, come down. But no one seemed to hear, certainly not McWatt, and a great choking moan tore from Yossarian's throat as McWatt turned again, dipped his wings once in salute, decided, "Oh, well, what the hell," and flew into a mountain. Colonel Cathcart was so upset by the deaths of Kid Samson and McWatt that he raised the missions to 65.